This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, Iraq falls into chaos. What's the U.S. obligation? Also, what threats can you make online without going to jail? I'm John Dickerson.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Patricia Lockwood's poetry is sexy and built for Twitter. Does that make it too mainstream for the poetry establishment? Then we'll see if it's possible to predict this year's Song of the Summer. And then 22 Jump Street, a remake that's fully self-aware, but is it any good?
Ladies, nobody cared about the Jump Street reboot, but you got lucky. So now this department has invested a lot of money to make sure Jump Street keeps going.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm John Dickerson in Washington. Iraq fell into chaos this week and President Obama sent military advisors. What's next and what is the U.S. obligation there? And then what kind of threats can you make online without ending up in the pokey? I'm joined in Washington today by Slate senior editor Will Dobson. Hello, Will.
Hi, John.
And in New Haven by Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hello, Emily.
Hey, John.
The extremist militant group Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS, has been sweeping through Iraq, taking territory, setting off a wave of violence and counterviolence from Shiite militia groups, and threatening the stability of the entire country. President Obama announced at a press briefing Thursday that he will deploy up to 300 American military advisors and said he is also considering airstrikes. Will Dobson, where do we take a hold of what looks like chaos getting more chaotic?
Well, it's a bad situation, but I will say that I think that the president hit it exactly correctly at the press conference today in, signaling that the United States is going to support the Iraqi government. But it's also, and I think it was really the important thing that he said was that the United States is not going to pick sides or even appear to be picking sides in a sectarian war. It's crucial that the United States, whether through airstrikes or drone strikes, does not appear to become, you know, effectively a Shiite air force. You do that, then you only are really bolstering the sectarian war, bolstering the case that Sunni extremists are making, and, by the way, seriously worrying Sunni Arabs throughout the Middle East. So, you know, right there, that has to be the check on U.S. military involvement. And the key thing is really political reform. I mean, the real problem here is Prime Minister Maliki and the lack of inclusiveness there. And so you've got to, if you are able to have a more inclusive government in place, which is something that should have been done long ago, if you were able to do that, you can begin to sap energy from the Sunni extremists. And if you can do that, you can begin to sap ISIS itself.
Well, Will, yes, about Maliki's government, that seems really clear. I imagine that's been clear all along, mm-hmm. and the U.S., I know, pushed for this much earlier and didn't get him to include Sunnis in his cabinet. Right? I mean, this is obviously not like this is news. So does the current crisis change the equation in a way that then pushes him to make meaningful steps, or is it just too late for that?
I mean, it takes a special kind of idiot to make a terrorist movement look like a liberation force, which is essentially what Maliki did for ISIS. So no, I don't think anyone anywhere is harboring great hopes that Maliki's going to see the light. Maliki, in many ways, and that's why you also don't want to be in the position of essentially buttressing his government. I mean, that's what the administration is sort of signaling, is that they're buttressing the government, but not a Maliki-stamped government. So that's why you're going to see, and they're hoping and they're looking to find someone to fill Maliki's shoes in a post-Maliki Iraq.
In conversations with administration officials, basically, ever since the Obama team came in, they have always been hyper worried about any U.S. involvement in the Middle East anywhere as being easily interpreted as the meddling hand of sort of the United States and the worst of the Bush years. So I guess my question is this. How can they think that this won't be seen as basic by the Sunnis as an attempt to prop up the Shiite-led government? Even though they say, yes, we're helping the government, that distinction will be totally lost if you use the frame that they've used through the whole administration which is like, you know, we're always seen as the worst invaders.
And that's why it's critical that this effort not just be a U.S.-led effort. That's where the role of the Iranians comes in here, that what you want Maliki, and not just Maliki, but Maliki's people to be hearing is the exact same thing from Tehran and Washington, which is, wait a minute, we meant it, you need to do this now. It will be totally meaningless unless there aren't more steps, more signals taken by Maliki and those around him that they actually will follow up with some meaningful reforms. The steps that have been taken in the last 7 days, though, wouldn't cut the mustard.
It sounds fantastical to my ears to hear you say, that's critical. That's why it's critical to have the U.S. and Tehran speaking with one voice. The U.S. and Tehran haven't spoken with one voice for 40 years.
You're right. But the interests here are real. I mean, you know, really, Iran was the biggest beneficiary of the war in Iraq. I mean, no one benefited more from that experience than Iran in terms of us essentially eliminating their chief enemy on their border. So now if the experiment in Iraq essentially explodes, it's exploding on Iran's doorstep. And this is a crucial issue for them, you know, across the board. So they have all the right incentives and we have all the right incentives to let them. And if they can experience a little Iraq war syndrome, that wouldn't hurt either.
And they're Shiite, so Maliki's supposed to listen to them, right?
Right.
Is the country really in danger of falling apart, or did a lot of these early gains that ISIS banked come from the fact that they were moving through areas that had more Sunni populations that they could ally with or who would at least be welcoming to them, and that once they get closer to Baghdad and get into Shiite areas, that it's harder?
No, I think it's actually, you can never really say Iraq is really in danger of falling apart. I mean, I think that, I mean, it is what you said is true, that yes, they were able to have the equivalent of a, you know, a Sunni blitzkrieg across Iraq. Yes, that's true. And you could say it's because of the demographic makeup of the places they were moving through. But it's also true during this window of time that the Kurds have seen the moment for what it is and seized Kirkuk and taken the steps to making their own mini Iraq, creating their own Kurdistan. You have now the real danger, a real danger that even if you keep ISIS, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles away from Baghdad, that you'll begin to see sectarian violence, bloodletting in the streets of Baghdad itself. You know, who says that ISIS has to march all the way through Baghdad to ultimately win this? They can win this if just you have that type of mass violence in the streets of Baghdad as people try to settle scores. And the real losers there will be the Sunni population of Baghdad. So you can very quickly see this falling apart. This is one of the most delicate places that Iraq has been at any point in the last decade. And that is really ultimately Iraq's fault in the sense that Maliki has blown what was an opportunity, a real opportunity that now is further from the horizon than it's been.
Emily, what's your take on the president's role here and what he has to do and what he's trying to manage here, the balance? For him, this is a guy who was elected to office in large measure because he publicly was against this war, then claims as one of his great successes having gotten out of Iraq. So how does he get back in if this isn't a war anymore?
Yeah, well, first of all, not that it will really matter, but he has a legal problem about whether Congress, you know, when they passed the authorization of use of military force back in 2001, would ever have intended re-entry into Iraq after we'd pulled out. I mean, even Dick Cheney is saying, mostly to taunt Obama, but he's right that the legal authorization here is really thin. And then you get into the Libya scenario where you essentially claim an exemption from the War Powers Act, and it's all a worrisome additional, you know, encroachment of executive authority. So there's that technical problem, which I'm sure they'll just figure out some way to sweep under the rug. But I just, this is such a nightmare for Obama policy-wise. I mean, he is the president who made his reputation in doing the opposite of what Bush did, getting out of Iraq. He does not want to be engaging in this area. And yet this is going to be very hard for him to ignore. He's already taking all kinds of bashing from, you know, hawks who are saying he caused this by pulling out too early, too fast, by not forcing Maliki to do the right thing earlier. It just seems like a complete mess for him. So I'm glad, Will, that you at least think he's, you know, sending the right message rhetorically here. But I just wonder if that is going to be, you know, watching the place burn in the end.
Is there a space, Will, between the overheated claims of those who, the hawks, who many of whom were supporters of the original Iraq War, I should say, the second Iraq War, who are now doing a big I told you so, saying the president should have signed some kind of status of forces agreement in 2011 before leaving, who say additionally that he's taken his eye off the ball when it comes to terrorist threats, who said, you know, he said al-Qaeda is on the run. Now you can talk about ISIS and whether it's a part of al-Qaeda or not, or has been even booted out of al-Qaeda for being too ugly. Is there some space between that, which is kind of the most political, ideological case, and a critique of the president that says, you know, he has sold the notion of the world as one in which basically we're moving out, we're withdrawing, and if we need to jump back in, we can with a counterterrorism force or some little drones here or something over there. But this situation seems like those kind of fixes aren't available to him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, first to take the sort of the political side, basically that's a lot of ways of saying, you know, Dick Cheney's op-ed.
I was trying. Dick Cheney's op-ed was so bad that I was trying to. There are others who are.
Yeah,
not
there
as
are
bad.
Others. There are others. Yeah. But, you know, Dick Cheney and friends. You know, and so, I mean, look, nothing made ISIS more likely to exist in this world than the war in Iraq. And it was Cheney and his friends who were the chief champions of the war in Iraq. So I won't connect the dots there, but there you go. Let's put them aside. So. And then there's the world that Obama inherits. And in that world, the president wants out. And the president wants out because everybody wants out. He's made shrewder political decisions or calculations than that one. Now, the question for me where this gets really murky is that, you know, by the president's own admission, yes, there are places where we can pick our spots. There are places where we can intervene and show modest use of force or influence. And the problem for me is that, at least I think that he missed that in his approach to Syria. That there's a debate about what the United States could have done in Syria where the Obama administration decided to do, let's just say, next to nothing. And that is, you can draw a direct line between those decisions and the problems we're having in Iraq now because ISIS is born in Syria. And part of the mistake of the administration was to think that that passivity in one place would somehow help us remain passive everywhere. And in fact, it's exactly the opposite. If you look at the speech that the president gave at West Point, which called for a very restrained foreign policy and basically articulated the view you just referred to, you know, that's a policy that basically almost no one that's a senior member of his foreign policy team subscribes to.
All right. That's going to have to do it on the first topic, but we're going to, of course, come back to this, I'm certain. Coming up, what kind of threats can you make online without ending up in jail? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm John Dickerson, along with Emily Bazelon and Will Dobson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. This week, the Supreme Court announced that it would hear the case of a Pennsylvania man who was convicted for threatening posts he made on the internet towards children, coworkers, and his ex-wife. The man, Anthony Alanis, I think is how you pronounce his name, claims that the comments were sort of reappropriated hip-hop lyrics and the product of a character that he developed, and therefore should just be considered free speech and not taken seriously. But he was convicted of four charges and related to interstate communications and I think sentenced to 4 years. Emily, where do you come down on this? I feel like I should be inhabiting Plotz's role as saying this is all just fine and you can say
I know. I'm sorry David's not here today. We're going to have to talk about this case again after argument so David can defend his usual First Amendment absolutist position. I just want to tell you a little bit more about what this guy did. So he kind of mused about blowing up elementary schools. There was a picture he took of himself holding a knife next to a coworker saying basically like, oh, I'm looking forward to doing this. Or not quite that, but something threatening. And then he posted things about his wife who was trying to leave him, such as, there's one way to love you, but 1,000 ways to kill you. I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood and dying from all the little cuts. So here is the legal question here. The question is, I suppose there's a threshold question, a beginning question about whether threats ever can be criminalized. You could go back to that. But according to current Supreme Court law, if you make what's called a true threat, yes, you can go to jail. So who gets to decide what a true threat is? Alanis wants his own intention to be the standard here. He's saying, hey, I was just parodying Eminem. I'm just trying to be a rap artist here. And he made little, you know, satirical meta jokes along the way about how he could get in trouble for posting these things.
He was willing to go to jail for his art.
Yeah, exactly. So does his supposed satirical intention, does that get him off the hook? Or is the fact that his wife testified that she was scared to death of him, is that the standard we should go by? And it seems to me that if we are going to criminalize threats, and we can talk about whether that's a good idea, but if we're going to do it, the idea that the stated intention of the threatener should be the test is just, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. And also the idea that you can call something a rap lyric or a like bad imitation rap lyric, and that means it's okay. That also I find so suspect. And yet that is very much the kind of pro-robust First Amendment position that a whole bunch of law professors are taking. I just think it makes no sense.
This is not a position, we should point out, that Abu Qatala claimed.
No, although it sounds like he could have.
He could have.
You know, maybe he's not mad at his ex-wife.
So how do you – is there a way in which the law, Emily, splits this baby where you have – I mean, there are cases all the time where it's sort of one person's view of things and the other person has a different view of things. And you can't take either of them as having the rule that should stand, right? So how do they normally split this baby?
Well, in different situations, you have different standards. Most of the time, the law goes with what's called the reasonable person standard. We look through the eyes of the reasonable person. If they thought X, that's what we're going with. Once in a while, though, you have what's called a subjective intent standard, where what matters is the actual intention of the person who was doing it, not how it looked to people on the outside. I just think in a case about threats, it is way too easy to come up with some after-the-fact justification about, you know, violent rap lyrics. And the other really interesting element of this case, and I wonder what you guys think about this, is the social media part of it. So Alanis's defense is, well, the world of social media, it opens up this whole new form of communication where you can be writing for no audience at all. And so the notion that his wife could have read this and felt threatened, well, that's kind of like an accidental byproduct of this speech. It's not what he meant. I just don't know anyone who posts on Facebook and thinks, oh, this is my private diary.
Yeah.
John?
Yes, it's the opposite. Right. So that's laughable.
To me, it's laughable. But I do think, on the other hand, I guess, that it is true that social media opens up this public way of speaking that then exposes people to disclosure, to being found out, that they don't anticipate. We got to imagine there are lots and lots of people putting violent and bloody threats on Facebook, and the very vast majority of them do not get caught. And sometimes people, once in a while, the cops will come knocking about something that someone wrote that they really did intend as a joke, they didn't back up in any way. It seems to me, again, was this threat directed at a particular person? Does it seem to actually have an individual target? And then, did that target take it seriously? Those, to me, are the important criteria here. But, you know, to just play David for a second, that's not a very First Amendment protective way of thinking about this.
Right. I mean, to be Plotzian about it, I mean, the thing that, you know, on the one hand, I'm concerned, and I think, you know, this case is, you know, coming in a context where we're all very concerned about the spate of gun deaths in the country and gun attacks and, you know, him bringing up, you know, an elementary school. Every time we then, when one of these instances occur, we then go back and say, well, why didn't anybody read their Facebook posts? You know, because every time their Facebook posts somehow seem to prefigure some horrific thing. And here's an instance where the authorities essentially are looking at this and say, oh, wait, let's, you know, go ahead and talk to this guy now. So, you know, bravo. But on the other hand, to take the more Plotzian view on this, is that, you know, prosecutors will take their liberties. And it's deeply concerning to think that because someone, you know, is influenced by the quote unquote wrong types of music or music lyrics, that in itself becomes, you know, exhibit, maybe not exhibit A, but exhibit B or C in the prosecution building a case that you actually had very violent intent.
But see, I don't think this guy's like being influenced by rap lyrics is really what's going on here. There are criminal cases in which I'm with you 100% where you have someone who's being tried for an actual crime, usually a black guy. And then it turns out he had a bunch of violent rap music, you know, on his iPod. And then that gets introduced as additional evidence that essentially like he's a bad guy. He really sucks. Let's throw him away, lock him up. you know, take away the key. But this guy, the whole crime is the threat. So it seems to me if you want to argue against this, then you essentially have to say that threats should be legal, that until someone actually commits an act of violence, warning someone else that you're about to potentially kill them just doesn't count. Imagine being this guy's wife, reading this stuff on his Facebook feed, fearing for your life, going to the police and having them say, you know what, I'm really sorry, but this does not rise to the level of stalking or our state statute of cyber harassment. We can't do anything. Good luck to you. Go live in a shelter for a while.
How do you think the court's going to come down on this?
It's going to be really interesting because this is a court that is just in love with the First Amendment in 8 million different ways, whether it's religious freedom. That's a little advertisement for the Hobby Lobby ruling that will surely come down the next 2 weeks. Or campaign finance and the rights of corporations and unions to give freely. I mean, or hate-filled protests at military funerals or snuff films that kill animals. I mean, this is a court that has basically said really icky, gross, despicable stuff and lots of rights for religion and corporations, all of that embraced by the First Amendment. And yet this case feels to me like it is a vehicle for pulling back and for going with the objective standard about how someone experiences a threat. I just feel like the chances they're going to go with, oh, I say that, you know, I'm just lionizing Eminem here. It just seems pretty implausible to me.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm John Dickerson in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum team up for more bromance in the movie 22 Jump Street. And then, should poetry be more ingratiating to its potential fans? We'll discuss as a kind of test case the critical reception of the young and very popular poet Patricia Lockwood. And finally, what makes a song the song of the summer? We'll discuss this with the critic Chris Malanfi, who covers the pop charts for Slate magazine. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
22 Jump Street is an action comedy starring Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum. It's filled with goofy, self-referential asides about its status as a sequel to a movie that itself was a reboot of a half-forgotten TV show. It is cheekily irrelevant, and just as predictably, it cleaned up over the weekend, pulling in something like 65% more at the BO than its predecessor. Is this all in good juvenile fun, or is there something else at work? First, let's listen to a clip.
Keith, hey. Gang.
Oh, you're twins.
We're brothers too.
No, he's not kidding. He's serious.
Oh, really?
Is one of y'all older?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you got crow's feet under your eyes, man. You specific.
We're actually just normal college age.
I mean, well, even if you're a little older, that's cool, man. Because, you know, girls here love older dudes.
That's true.
Plus, it's math girls here, man.
I don't know. At the end of the day, you just kind of want something that's just a little deeper, really.
Yeah
deeper. Jinx, buy me a Coke. Oh, snap, man, we're still saying the same thing. This is amazing. Carrots, pumpernickels, glow sticks, twins.
That's crazy. We have that brother connection, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You ready?
Yep.
Pirates,
paper clips,
baby
bananas,
feet,
I don't know.
Anger,
words,
quicksand,
shoes.
Boom!
Yeah. That's still making me laugh in the studio a couple days after seeing the movie. We should explain a bit. So the plot of 22 Jump Street is very self-consciously touted to be exactly the same as the plot of 21 Jump Street, except for that instead of infiltrating a drug ring at a high school, they're infiltrating a drug ring at a college. So in this scene, they're moving into their freshman dorm room and meeting their across the hall neighbors, some very in sync comedic twins.
Who were played by Keith and Kenny Lucas in, I think, a very scene-stealing, one of many scene-stealing small roles in this movie.
Yeah, very funny. Dana, your persnickety tribe, known as the critics, didn't seem too offended by this, nor too turned on by this movie. Where did you fall on the continuum?
I mean, I think cheekily irrelevant is a great way to put it, as you put it in your setup. The people who made it, Chris Miller and Phil Lord, I mean, when it comes to animation, I feel like those guys are the one, which is the very construct that was deconstructed in the Lego movie, which was their second animated movie. They've made two movies, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and the Lego movie, which to me are both animated triumphs, and then these two Jump Street movies, which are both sort of very good for what they are, very aware of their own silliness, and cannily exploiting the talent of Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill as this comedy team. And I don't have a lot more to say about this movie than that, but it doesn't surprise me that it did run away with the box office because it knows what it's doing within this limited and over-familiar genre.
This is so interesting. I mean, I did, you know, I looked a little bit into the CVs of the creators of the movie, Julia, and was surprised to find that they were associated with the two movies that Dana points out, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and the Lego Movie. And I agree with her assessment of those movies. I like this way more than I thought I was going to. What about you?
I feel like you guys are totally whitewashing the conversation we had about the Lego Movie. We were ambivalent about the Lego Movie, weren't we? Or was that just me? But isn't there something, I mean, if these are the new comedy overlords of Hollywood, which they basically are, they've got this hugely successful live action comedy franchise. And in both this movie and the Lego Movie, they are trying to have it both ways. They want to make fun of the conventions of the genre that they're working in while totally exploiting those and laughing all the way to the bank in a way that feels very meta and modern and sort of asks you to short circuit your own critical faculties a little bit to enjoy the movies. I don't know. There's something fishy about it. I don't like it. I don't like it. I mean, I love it. I thought it was really funny. I would recommend that you go see it. But it feels sinister. I think there's something sinister that this movie and the Lego Movie have in common.
I think I want to pursue that line of thought because I can sense that gambit happening a little bit in these Jump Street movies. Although, I mean, as I said, I think that they are such sort of irrelevant summer fun that I can't get too upset about it. But I just don't feel that in the Lego Movie at all. I feel like that movie wears its heart on its sleeve. In addition to, you know, having a very kind of meta and clever way of presenting its jokes, there's a real sweetness and warmth and respect for childhood in that movie. And now I'm talking about the Lego Movie and not the movie we're here to discuss. But
all right, yeah, we don't need to rehash the Lego Movie, but for those of our listeners who haven't seen this movie, you know, just to give you a taste of it a little bit, is very early on in the movie, the most, you know, winking and self-referential scene is with a character, this deputy police chief Hardy, who sits them down and tells them that their new mission is going to be exactly like the mission in the first film. And he does it in such a way that he's not talking about the mission, he's talking about the movie that they're in now, that it's going to be repetitive, it's going to be a total facsimile. He says it's always worse the second time around. He even uses the word reboot, which is your kind of Variety insider critic's way of talking about, you know, creating a franchise out of some old TV show. It's really self-referential. And Julia, the funny thing is you used the sort of old man Heidegger word that I was going to use in my own intro, but then decided against, which was sinister. It seems playful, but it also seems kind of a little, why is it sinister? There is something sinister, but I can't put my finger on what.
I think one response I've had to this film, I mean, and this film has so many jokes about being a sequel. In some ways, the subject of this movie is being a sequel, right? It has a lot of, makes a lot of fun of it. It makes sport of it. And most of the jokes are quite funny. That monologue you described with Nick Offerman is very funny. There's also a lot of jokes about the budgets of sequels. Like, they talk, the new Jump Street office is directly across the street from the old Jump Street office. And instead of being in a Latino church, it's in a Vietnamese church. And it kind of looks like the set of 24. There's a lot of clear glass and smooth chromed metal and blue lit electronic gewgaws. And they joke about how the budget's through the roof so they can do all these crazy scenes. And then they run out of money midway through the sequel and have to do a hokey chase scene in a go-kart. The movie has a lot of fun with it, and I enjoyed it and was laughing and having a thrilling time at the theater. I think the thing that's sinister is maybe not so much these comic spirits behind the film, because I agree, Dana, there is warmth and heart in this movie just as there was in the Lego Movie. I mean, the relationship between Jonah Hill's Schmidt and Channing Tatum's, some critic called him a meat stick, which I'm going to use instead of the name of the character he plays, Jenko. Jenko the meat stick. There's warmth in that relationship that's genuine and fun at the core of this movie, and that's part of why it works and all of the meta commentary doesn't just fall to pieces around the edges of the film. But I guess I feel like the machinery of Hollywood is so cynical at this point, right? It's like, oh, the original Jump Street reboot did great, so let's do a reboot of the reboot for a sequel. And they, maybe it's because they have so much heart, they feel like they have to put this carapace of self-deprecation and acknowledgement about how shoddy the concepts of these films are, mm-hmm. that they can then create artful, hilarious stories in. And it just made me wish that Hollywood could just let them make an original film. Maybe that film would be spineless and less fun, and they're brilliant at this and I should just appreciate it. But somehow, a self-aware Hollywood that understands how creatively bankrupt it is in terms of what sort of films actually get financed is just depressing and, yes, sinister on some level, even though I had probably more fun at these two movies than I've had at most other movies I've seen this year, and I would recommend people see both of them. To me, they're symptoms of a Hollywood that's disappointing and sad.
Julia, you're really channeling Steve. You're channeling the authenticity ghost.
300 episodes in, and Julia has, I've turned you into me, Julia. I've succeeded.
I don't know what it is about these two in particular. Obviously, usually I'm on the other side of this argument. I think it's their sheer virtuosity. I think they're so funny. I think they're so talented. And to see, I don't know, it's one thing to derive pleasure from, you know, the lumbering behemoth of a Michael Bay movie that just is Michael Baying itself into loudness and confusion and enjoy that for what it is. But it's another to feel like maybe two of the greatest comic talents in Hollywood at the moment are just subjected to the machine. I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm just gonna go like paint an anarchy symbol on the wall over here.
Rage against the machine, Julia.
I'm marginally better at being me than you are at being me. So let me explain what it is you're trying to say, which is that there's the sinister quality comes from a parallel between Hollywood trying to forgive its terminal lack of originality by covering it in self-conscious irony. There's a parallel between that and a certain kind of young man to whom this movie is supposed to appeal, by the way, who thinks he can get away with absolutely all of his worst qualities of callowness, shallowness, self-centeredness by being funny and self-conscious about them. And some of the superficially best, most entertaining people are extremely funny and self-conscious about their own foibles. Over time, you can come to realize, in fact, what they've done is completely forgiven themselves and have begged on an ongoing basis for forgiveness for being sophomoric, like being terminally sophomoric. I want to say I stayed for every last minute of this movie, and I did laugh reliably every 90 seconds.
Well, the closing credit sequence is one of the best parts. So you do, if you see it, have to stay for every minute of the movie.
Okay, the movie is 22 Jump Street. It stars Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum. It's opening everywhere on the inside of your eyelids. It's probably there at this point. But see it. If you see it, come tell us what you thought of it. Coming up, is Patricia Lockwood the vanguard of modern poetry or a social media flash in the pan? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and Dana Stevens. And this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, guess what? We collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, while you're there, if you will, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next topic. Is poetry a just inheritance for all mankind, or is it a coterie art, a preserve for the credentialed and the knowing? It seems we're doomed to have some version of this conversation once every few years. The latest comes in two related installments. First, a BBC presenter named Jeremy Paxman was asked to judge a prestigious UK poetry prize, and he offered up some choice quotes to the press, including he wished poetry would, quote, raise its game a little bit, raise its sights, and, quote, aim to engage with ordinary people much more. He says that he loves poetry, but he maintains that it's connived at its own irrelevance. And then in the second installment, at least of our discussion of this issue, there is an American poet named Patricia Lockwood who has started to become relevant in exactly the way Paxman is presumably implying poets should. Lockwood's success delights some people. It seems to chagrin others. We'll get to that in a second. But Julia, let me start with you. Do you secretly wish that poetry was more like a song of the summer or a blockbuster movie? Or are you glad that it's a quiet preserve for those who love it?
I think that, in general, the notion that poetry is a subset of the MFA subculture that we've already talked about, which is sort of insular and a bunch of writers talking to each other and working off of each other's notions of what good work is in this day and age, that poetry operates that way even more exponentially so, because there is no, you know, there is no Jonathan Franzen to hold up to the cloistered world of, you know, academic poets, or there are very few, right? And we get a new poet laureate every so often.
One was just named last week, Charles Wright.
Right. That could be another cause for our occasion. But, you know, it's not like the poet laureates are often household names before they become poet laureate. So it seems insular. I'd like for them to have a segment on the nightly news. I don't know what form it takes, but I was applauding the bomb throwing a little bit.
I mean, it seems that poetry has always bloomed in the dark and will continue to do so, and that any attempt to tie it to some sort of civic authority is always going to be tenuous at best, and in the current culture is just really almost a joke. I mean, I was reading a profile of Charles Wright, the new poet laureate who was named last week, who, by the way, sounds like this wonderful man. Talk about the Belle of Amherst. He's just a guy who lives in a shed in the woods somewhere and is like 10 miles from the nearest phone or something. That's how cut off he is from the world, and he's now going to be our poet laureate. But the most telling and chilling detail in this profile of the new poet laureate is, do you know how much the poet laureate is paid by the U.S. government, by our tax dollars? It pays $35,000 a year plus a $5,000 travel stipend to be the poet laureate. And it just seemed to me like a symbol for how our governmental relationship to the arts has atrophied.
All right. Well, why don't we move on to the second part of the conversation, which is there's a poet named Patricia Lockwood who's very young and very photogenic and very Twitter friendly, who's becoming enormously, by the standards of poetry, enormously popular. She's recently been profiled in The New York Times Magazine, and then the Daily Critic, book critic for The New York Times, the sublime Dwight Garner, has written about her. Patricia Lockwood's sexy, surreal, and mostly sublime poems seem to have been, as James Joyce said in Ulysses about a batch of folktales, quote, printed by the Weird Sisters in the year of the big wind, close quote. And then Dwight goes on to say, they scatter lightning and lawn debris across your psyche. Dana, Patricia Lockwood is very, very good on Twitter. She has something like 30,000 followers. It may have doubled since I last looked. She's also very well known for a poem that, of all things, a poem that went viral called Rape Joke. What do you make of her growing celebrity? And what do you make of that poem? I'm very curious to know, because I'm not sure I know what I think of either.
Well, I mean, I feel like I should start the discussion of Patricia Lockwood by saying that I can't weigh in on her as a critic talking about all of her poetry. She has, what, two or three books of poems now? I mean, I feel like we're dealing with her here more as a Twitter presence, a kind of media personality, and the author of Rape Joke, which is this poem that went incredibly viral last summer. There was just a period that everyone on my feed anyway was talking, tweeting, reacting to this poem, Rape Joke, which exists somewhere on the boundaries between performance art, searingly satirical stand-up comedy, and poetry, right? Because it was sort of it's a poem that sort of reads, as several of her poems do that I've read, as a series of tweets itself. It's sort of a series of small oracular pronouncements that is in part confessional about her own rape, something that happened to her when she was 19, and in part, I guess you would say, sort of a deconstruction of the national conversation about rape, what we mean when we say rape, what we mean when we say joke, whether it's possible to make a joke. The poem itself is full of jokes. It's a poem that's difficult to read because of the subject matter, but is also playful and witty in a strange way. And I thought it was an extremely powerful performance.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, that poem is an incredible performance, and just send it right up George Will's nose as far as I'm concerned. But Julia, this has obviously become a very gendered discussion, not our discussion, but the discussion online about Patricia Lockwood. A lot of the people writing somewhat hesitant and potentially critical assessments of her appear to be men. There are a lot of women critics chiming in, defending her and pointing out how male critics deprive writerly authority, women of writerly authority. Where do you fall on this Patricia Lockwood subject?
Well, I mean, I think if we circle this back around to the Paxman point, I think it's only been good for poetry for there to be like a national conversation around Patricia Lockwood. I think some of it has gotten a bit heated. That three of the most prominent reviews of the book were written by men. There was one in the New Yorker on the New Yorker's website that did seem a little bit condescending and somewhat mansplainy, that sort of said, well, I'm concerned that Twitter may be cheapening Patricia Lockwood's poetry. Perhaps she's gotten too used to the gimmick punchline call and response of Twitter, and the poetry is less complex, perhaps, than her early, more obscure work. I think there are legitimate beefs with that particular review. I think then there were a couple critics, including Mallory Ortberg, whose work I love on The Toast, who said, like, how come it's all men reviewing this book? I found that conversation didn't seem like a particularly useful lens through which to view this work. I mean, I think there is something about poetry, I think, comes back to the central question. Here's a woman who's performing poetry very publicly, who's doing it in an unexpected forum, who makes the explicit subject of her work sex, with which both attracts interest, right? It's more fun to read a poem about sex than it is maybe to read a poem about, like, the abstract nature of being. I think some of her poems are about both, but there are ways in which people discount the publicness of her work, the popularity of her work, and the subject matter of her work, and perhaps do some of that because she's a woman doing all of this, and not like, you know, perhaps if it were a man doing similar work, he would just be getting accolades for breaking boundaries. But I think it's been good for poetry that there's been this conversation about her work and a set of people who want to engage with it. And I think one thing that comes across in those reviews is that her work makes people uncomfortable because of the explicit sexuality, because she is so reader focused and so good at kind of pushing particular buttons and anticipating and short circuiting responses. I mean, in some ways, she's a poet who has a lot in keeping with the creators of 22 Jump Street, who's so aware of the way in which you are going to receive her work that she's sort of manipulating and commenting on that as she produces it, which can get under your skin a bit and wig you out. But I think that's basically a testament to the power of her writing and whether it fits as classically poetry, quote unquote, or whether she's creating some new medium online that borrows from the tradition of poetry and is actually transforming it into something slightly new. I think it's going to be exciting to follow her work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, her latest collection is Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals. I'm very curious to know what listeners of ours make of her work. Come tell us at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, moving on. When Stephen Colbert devotes an entire show to satirizing the competition for the Song of Summer of the Century, the very idea of one song to rule them all between Memorial Day and Labor Day has reached a certain status, so writes the wonderful Chris Malamphy in Slate magazine. He goes on to say it's become both an American tradition and something so overhyped it's worth questioning. Chris, let's begin with the sort of platonic concept, and then we'll force specifics to conform to it. But what did your research tell you? What is a Song of Summer? Is it a legit concept even to begin with?
I found myself defending the concept of the Song of Summer when I wrote that piece for Slate at the end of last summer, because the whole premise for it started when Chuck Eddy, who's a pretty well-known music critic, came on social media and said to me, Chris, is a Song of Summer even a thing? Because it seems to me that there are many songs of the summer, and why should there be just one? And, you know, why do we turn it into this grudge match? And what my research showed was that if you go back as far back as, say, the 60s, there were artists who were pretty self-consciously trying to create a song of the summer. I mean, probably the most well-known one from the 60s is Summer in the City by the Love and Spoonful. It came out in July. It spent 3 weeks at number one. It spent more weeks at number one than any other song in the summer of 66. And it was pretty clearly the song of the summer. What my research also turned up, though, is that the hype around Song of Summer is a fairly new thing. Like, if you do a Nexus search, there's not a whole lot of grudge match Song of the Summer stuff, certainly before the 90s. And then you start to turn up these articles in the 90s. Ann Powers did one. Stephen Talty in the New York Times Magazine did one in 1995, where they're sort of positing that, you know, during the summer, this is much like Hollywood movie season, where the big hits come to play. And now in the, you know, sort of blogging and social media era, everybody seems to have an opinion on this, and it's kind of snowballed. And I noticed that year after year, the Song of Summer meme, it appears in newspapers earlier, it's covered by more people. And for the piece we're about to talk about now, one of the reasons I did this in a slightly different way this year was I sort of felt like, well, we don't need to make, you know, just a simple predictions article. That's been done. Time Magazine did one. You know, Gawker did one. Everybody's done that. So why don't we talk about, you know, what your Song of the Summer is? So that's where we came at it.
Right. And we should describe a little bit what you did for Slate this year, Chris, which is basically create a Song of Summer contest where you go in and select which of the four top contenders for Song of Summer for, I think, the past 5 years, and then each 5 years back before that, back to the early 80s.
Right.
And then it spits out what's going to be your song for this summer. So I liked it, sort of acknowledged that in the fractured marketplace, there are multiple contenders and we'll all have multiple favorites instead of perhaps one true king.
Right.
Do you want to walk us through some of your selections? Because I took the quiz and I got Fancy by Iggy Azalea featuring
Charlie XCX.
I'm so fancy. You already know I'm in the best lane. From LA to Tokyo.
All right, so this song's been in my head since it was pointed out to me by your generator. Tell us why this is a contender.
I mean, first of all, it may wind up winning the whole ball of wax because it's already number one, and it's been number one for about a month. And it seems like an unlikely hit when you describe it to somebody because it's, you know, a white female Australian rapper who has learned to rap like a Southern African-American, really male rapper because her model is T.I., who's her mentor. But it's got that Charlie XCX hook, which, as I may have noted before, you know, she's kind of a genius at these great summer pop hooks. She sang the hook on I Love It by Icona Pop last year. That that thumping beat that it's got, it's kind of an electro beat, so not your typical sort of hip-hop break beat. And I can speak from my own experience that on the street I live in Brooklyn, somebody was thumping that thing over and over again, and just the sound of that thump, it's almost like it was made for booming out of a Jeep. So it doesn't surprise me at all that it's kind of taken off as the temperature's gotten warmer.
Dana or Steve, did you get that song?
No, my result was actually the song that was going to be one of my favorites from the lineup we were looking at anyway, which was Do It Again by Robin and Royce Kopp. Yeah. And I think one of the things that appealed to me about Do It Again is that it has a very similar kind of lyrical content and a sense of romantic yearning as Hang With Me, which was one of my favorite of our summer strut list, another Robin song from a few summers ago. It has that same summer romance kind of theme of like, this is going to be horribly painful, but let's do it anyway again and again.
She's kind of the queen of the this is going to be horribly painful.
Yeah, but it's like masochism in the club, you know.
Totally.
Yeah, I just want to dance on a beach to that song.
Right. It's pretty irresistible. What's crazy about Robin is that, like, her hit-making days, she started out in the late 90s as, like, part of the teen pop boom of Backstreet and Britney, and she was promoted that way. She actually had top 10 hits here in America. And then she kind of went back to Sweden and was woodshedding and has kind of emerged as this indie pop goddess in the last 5 to 10 years. So, like, this song is definitely sort of, let's call it a hipster summer hit, but it's not like on top 40 radio. Frankly, it totally deserves to be. It's really catchy and really good.
Steve, I think you have to speak. Did you pick out any favorites? Did you do the quiz?
Okay, well, you're all on the edge of your seat, so I'll let you know what the Song of Summer is going to be. I inputted all of my summer jiggy into the generator, and I got Franz Schubert's Die Schöne Müller, which I think for sheer ubiquity factor is just a shoe-in, and it's already thumping on my block in Ghent, New York, out of the pickup trucks. So, and I should say also it was very much like last year's competition. It went down to the wire with some of the Satie Gymnopédie, but anyway, funny stuff. I'm going to go with the Robin. I actually didn't do the online song generator. I forgot to do my homework, but I like that Robin song, and I'm part of the, you know, a certain crowd that's going to push for that to become the juggernaut. All right. Well, everyone listening to us, go to Slate and take this interactive quiz that Chris Malanthi has designed in order to find your perfect song of the summer. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show. As always, a total pleasure.
Thank you very much, Steve. It was a pleasure for me too.
All right, well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Well, since we were talking about poetry this week, which is such a rare treat, I love when we talk about poetry on the show or read it, I wanted to recommend a poet this week, a young female poet, probably in her 30s, who has 3 books. Her name is Brenda Shaughnessy, and she's someone I know very slightly from my Berkeley days because she studied at Berkeley, but who mainly I know through her work, and she's just an incredible, incredible poet. Her poetry appears here and there, but it's been collected in 3 collections, 3 books. Her first is called Interior with Sudden Joy. The second is called Human Dark with Sugar. And one that I didn't know about, she now has a newish one called Our Andromeda. So I recommend anything by Brenda Shaughnessy. And if you get a chance to ever go or hear read in person, she's fabulous.
Julia, what do you have?
I also have a poetry-related endorsement. I'm going to endorse poetry, not the genre, but the magazine. I had the occasion to look over several recent issues of poetry recently, and it is such a good magazine. If you think of yourself as someone who loves poetry or loves studying poetry at any point in your academic career but doesn't have a great way to relate to it now or aren't really quite sure where to find poetry or incorporate it into your life, go right now and subscribe to poetry. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to it. It is such an intelligently constructed magazine. And it's incredibly admirable because the foundation that runs it got this enormous grant, right, from Joan Kroc. I think it was like 10 years ago now, gajillions of dollars to put toward poetry. And the temptation with that much money would be to like trick it out, blow it up, do some kind of like multimedia hullabaloo with an interactive app and whatnot. And it's incredibly restrained, perhaps as befits the genre, but so intelligently curated. There's interesting poems. There's interesting ancillary work around the poems, interviews with authors. There's sort of thematic collections, poetry that, that children might enjoy, poetry not written for children that children might enjoy was one recent theme issue. That book by Eliza Griswold, Collecting the Land Days from Afghanistan, which I endorsed a couple months ago, was initially collected in a special issue of Poetry Magazine. It really, like, you should be subscribing to poetry. If you've ever loved poetry, you should be subscribing to this magazine now. It's at the top of its game.
Okay, well, really briefly, I'm going to heartily endorse the Jill Lepore piece in the current New Yorker magazine. It's called The Disruption Machine, What the Gospel of Innovation Gets Wrong. And it's a wonderful and empirically driven, in some ways, also morally driven exploration of the whole notion of disruption in business. It's a overwhelmingly omnipresent meme in the business world, especially the tech world right now, that there are large, lumbering, slow to adapt companies that whose lunch is about to get eaten on a constant basis by small, nimble, disruptive technologies. It turns out this cliche is completely false, and that if you actually examine the people who've evangelized, the evidence marshaled by the people who evangelize on its behalf, they get that evidence completely wrong. In fact, this is not principally how innovation or business success happens, even in American culture. And so what it really turns out to be, as Lepore points out, is an ideological meme and not an economic or financial or business-centered meme. And she's done, I mean, I really mean this, I think she's done an incredible service via her own intellectual labor to debunk this, and debunk she did. It's not a moralizing or hectoring piece. She doesn't get up on her high horse and say it shouldn't be a commanding metaphor. She says, actually, it's wrong. It's actually on the facts wrong that this is how the cycle of business health unfolds. So anyway, highly recommended. It's a great piece. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Wolo. Our interns are Max Tanney and Anna Scheckman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.